Well, good morning. It's lovely to be with you. And last time I was here was the day before the first lockdown was announced. I remember Stuart asking me to still come across, and a bit like how it is today, just a few of us here, and you were all at home. And well, I didn't think that I would be coming back nearly a year later and it would still be the same, but here we are. It's lovely to be with you, and for those that know me, it's a privilege to be here, and it's just a shame that I can't see you and be with you in person. For those that don't know me, as was said at the beginning, my name is Alan Peel. I am a street preacher, an evangelist, and I go out onto the streets around Merseyside and share the gospel with people. But on a Sunday, I will often be in a church, again, sharing the good news of Jesus Christ. So what does a street preacher do when he's locked down? Well, in lockdown we are, just like everyone else. I am at home at the moment. I'm not allowed out onto the streets. So I am preparing. I'm coming up with new material, new talks, new ideas, studying, time in prayer and reading, and strengthening in my knowledge and faith as well. So it's really a time for preparation, and that's what we've been doing. When lockdown is over and non-essential shops are open, well, then we're allowed back out again. And so from June to November last year, we were out on the streets in all tiers. Apart from tier four, we were able to be out on the streets. So even at the time when Liverpool was the worst place in the country to live, we were still able to be out on the streets sharing the gospel. So do please pray for tomorrow, that as Boris Johnson gives his roadmap ahead, that we would have some sort of idea of when that would be again, when non-essential shops would be open. Well, I don't think we're expecting it to be just yet, but just to have a date would be good, and to plan towards a time. So that's what I've been doing at the moment, been preparing for when I can go back out again. Thank you also for your prayers for us personally. Many of you were praying for my wife, and kind of me, but mainly for her during the pregnancy. She was bedbound throughout, as some of you know, and I can announce that Asher was born safely in May, and he is healthy, he's happy. Asher means happiness, it means blessing, and he's living up to both of those meanings at the moment. He's certainly very happy, and he's definitely been a blessing. He's growing, he's got teeth, he's crawling, he's pulling himself up, he's attracted to things he shouldn't touch, and has no interest in things that he's allowed to touch, just like all good babies. Beth is pretty much fully recovered. They say it takes a woman about 2 years to get over the birth of a child. So, physically she's still not fully there, but she's no longer bedbound. She's no longer nauseous, and feels a bit more like herself. So thank you very much for your prayers. Asher is 9 months old tomorrow, so it's crazy to think he's been out of the womb for as long as he was in the womb. It felt like he was in the womb for about 10 years, but now he is happy and thriving. So thank you for your prayers. Well, it's a privilege for me to be here, and I'm looking forward to being here again three more times before the end of April. But unfortunately for you, I will be here four times. So I was thinking about what I could bring, what I could share, and none of the dates are consecutive, 1 week after the other. So I didn't want to do a set series and look at a book and try and get through the whole thing in my times here. But equally, I didn't want to just pick random passages every time. So I've settled on Exodus 1 to 3. This morning we'll look at Exodus chapter 1. And next time in March will be the first half of chapter 2. And then twice in April would be the end of chapter 2 and chapter 3, finishing with the burning bush. So that's my plan. Hopefully it will be a blessing. Hopefully they will be of benefit to you. So I'm going to read from Exodus chapter 1 now. I'll read the whole chapter from verse 1 up to and including verse 22. So Exodus chapter 1 and verse 1. These are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob, each with his household: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan and Naphtali, Gad and Asher, All the descendants of Jacob were 70 persons. Joseph was already in Egypt. Then Joseph died, and all his brothers and all that generation. But the people of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong, so that the land was filled with them. Now there arose a new king over Egypt, who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, "Behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply and, if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land." Therefore they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. They built for Pharaoh store cities, Pithom and Ramses. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread abroad. And the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel. So they ruthlessly made the people of Israel work as slaves, and made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick, and in all kinds of work in the field. In all their work, they ruthlessly made them work as slaves. Then the king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiphrah and the other Puah, "When you serve as a midwife to the Hebrew women and you see them on the birth stool, if it is a son, you shall kill him. But if it is a daughter, she shall live." But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but let the male children live. So the king of Egypt called the midwives and said to them, "Why have you done this and let the male children live?" And the midwives said to Pharaoh, "Because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and give birth before the midwife comes to them." So God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and grew very strong. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, "Every son that is born to the Hebrews you shall cast in the Nile, but you shall let every daughter live." It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief. It was the epoch of incredulity. It was the season of light. It was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope. It was the winter of despair. We had everything before us. We had nothing before us. Do you recognize those words? That's the well-known opening to Charles Dickens's historical novel, The Tale of Two Cities. It's a story, in the story is a love story between Charles Darnay and Lucy Manet. A story that takes place in two cities, London and Paris, during the time of the French Revolution. I don't know about you, I remember sitting through school lessons and hearing of the French Revolution, but I must admit, I don't really remember much about it. According to Wikipedia, the French Revolution happened in the mid-1700s, and it happened because the population of France, and particularly Paris, grew massively. It meant that there wasn't enough food to go around, so as a result, food prices increased, as did poverty, unemployment, and homelessness. And while the majority of France starved, its royalties and its higher class, its royalty and higher classes lived in luxury. And so revolution broke out. They overthrew the monarchy and brought in democracy. And it's widely thought to be a key point in the history, certainly of France and also Europe and the world. That's the backdrop to it, the backdrop to the revolution and to Dickens's novel. And it's very similar to what we've read here in Exodus. We have a population that has increased greatly, and a corrupt leadership who are very selfish and only really care about themselves. But instead of a love story or a tale of two cities, we have a tale of two fears. The writer of Exodus, he carries on at where Genesis ends. After being reunited with him, Joseph's father and brothers leave Canaan to come and live in Egypt, where Joseph is. We read it was around 70 people in the family of Israel who came to live in Egypt. And after having a little nod to the past, the writer then moves on quickly to the future and tells us that all the people that they've just mentioned pass away. The whole generation dies. But that's not the end of the people of Israel. Far from it. Over the next 300 years, God blesses the descendants of Abraham in accordance to his promises to Abraham. And we read that they increase greatly, they multiply and grow exceedingly strong, and that the land is full of them. God promised Abraham back in Genesis chapter 15, a man who had no children, that from his child would come a great nation. And so here, although Abraham didn't see it fulfilled, and neither did his son or his grandson or even his great-grandson, God has remembered his promise and is faithful to it. And the family of Israel, those 70 people, have now become the nation of Israel. Sadly, though, there are always those who despise the blessing of the Lord, particularly when it falls on other people, and trouble comes in verse 8. That trouble comes in the form of a new king in Egypt. And we read a key piece of information about him. Verse 8, we read, "Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph." Here is a man who is ignorant of his history. He knows nothing of Joseph, nothing of how the Lord used him to save Egypt during a great famine, and nothing of why these people are in Egypt. All he has, without his knowledge, is a fear. He looks on these people, this great number of foreign people living in Egypt, in his land, and he is afraid of them. And so here we have our first fear. We have the new king on the throne, and his fear is the fear of man. Verse 9, he said to his people, "Behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us." And we see that Pharaoh has two fears when it comes to these people. Mainly one, but there's a secondary fear as well. Firstly, he is in fear of their strength. He looks at these people, he sees that they are too many and too mighty. He sees not only the strength of their arm, but their number. And he sees the strength of their unity. Why is this something to fear? Well, he goes on, doesn't he? "Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply, and if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us." They are a great nation within a nation. I don't know if you've ever seen San Marino. They're one of those nations that if you get them in a World Cup qualifier, you know you're going to win at least 7-0. And when you're watching football, I watched and I thought, who are San Marino? Where are they? Well, San Marino is a nation within Italy. It's quite strange. And I think that really it's a similar idea to what we have here. That we have a great nation of Hebrew people living in Egypt. And he's afraid that if war breaks out and this great number of people side with the enemies, then there would be an enemy outside and also an enemy within. And it would mean the end of Egypt. So he's afraid of their strength. But I think there's more to it than that. Because if that was all of it, then there's an easy solution to that, isn't there? The easy solution is just to say, Can you leave, please? Can you get out of our land? So you're too many and too mighty for us. A bit like what some parents wish they could say to their teenage children. You're big enough to look after yourself. Go and live on your own. But he doesn't do that, does he? Because there's a secondary fear. He goes on and he says, if war breaks out and they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land. Pharaoh doesn't want them in Egypt because of their strength, but at the same time, he doesn't want them to leave. U2 famously sang, I can't live with or without you. And I get the feeling that Pharaoh can understand that idea. He's afraid of the threat that Israel is living in Egypt. But at the same time, he doesn't want them to leave. Why? I'm not too sure. There's a number of ideas that I think would be true. I think it's undoubtedly political. There would have been, they would have added to society, they would have contributed to society. Many scholars believe that they were providing free labor. There's also the possibility that Israel would not have been favorably looked upon by the Egyptians. I think when we read Genesis chapter 47, how they came into Egypt, I don't think it would mean a positive view on the Israelites. In those days, they're in the middle of the 7-year famine that God warned Pharaoh of in the dream. And the people of Egypt have got no food. They come to Joseph for food. They buy, they spend all their money on food. When that has gone, then they give up their livestock to Pharaoh in exchange for food. When that's gone, they sell even their land in order to get food. They have nothing. They are giving away all that they have. Purely to survive. And then in verse 27 of Genesis 47, we read in that backdrop, with them suffering greatly with the famine, we read that Joseph's family come to Egypt and they're welcomed in and they're given food and possessions within Egypt. I don't think that would have gone down too well. I don't know what Egypt's immigration policy was, but I can't imagine that would have been looked upon greatly. And I'm almost certain that there would have been repercussions further down the line. And these Egyptians would have looked and despised upon these people. And so I think there's probably more political motives behind him not wanting them to leave. But I also think as well that Satan is behind this. God promised Abraham that from his child would come a great nation, and one of the other promises was that they would have a land to call their own. Well, God, as I've already mentioned, is being faithful to his promises. The descendants of Abraham are a great nation, and Satan, wanting to fight against God, I'm sure this is an early attempt to try and stop them having a land of their own. Whatever the reasons, Pharaoh does not want them to leave. And, he's afraid. He's afraid of their strength, and he's afraid that they will leave. It's important to note, he's not afraid of them because they are a threat to his life or his health. Neither of those are in danger by the presence of the Israelite people in Egypt. He feels that through them, there is a potential threat to his power, his position, his status, his wealth, his kingdom. And so, he reacts. And we read, as we go through Exodus 1, of how Pharaoh sets about to stop these things from happening. His first one is purely to put them to hard work. Come, let us deal with them shrewdly. Set taskmasters over them, afflict them with heavy burdens. But we read in verse 12 that this didn't work. It fails. The more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread abroad. So they fail on both counts. And the Egyptians are in dread of them. This just breeds more fear. So plan A is scrapped, and they go to plan B. There's a change. No longer are they dealt with shrewdly, with taskmasters, but now they are dealt with ruthlessly, and they are made to work as slaves. They are under slavery. They are in bondage to the people of Egypt. Pharaoh can do as he likes with these people now that they are his slaves. But it doesn't appear to work. And so then, verse 15, the king of Egypt tries plan C. Call a midwife. And he calls in the midwives and he says, if you see a Hebrew woman on the birth stool and that you are attending the birth and you see that it's a son, you are to kill him. How Pharaoh proposed they went about this with mother and father stood on looking, I'm not too sure. But this is what he tells them to do. Kill the boys and save the girls. Again, I don't know how many times it would take before the Hebrew women got onto the fact that if they had a boy, it died, and if they had a girl, it lived. But Pharaoh doesn't care. He just wants an end to the problem. And the midwives refuse. We'll come to them later on because they also fear, but they don't fear Pharaoh. And we read, the people multiplied and grew very strong. So Pharaoh moves from plan A to plan B to plan C and now into plan D. And just permission for full-blown massacre. And he commands all his people, every son that is born to the Hebrews, you shall cast into the Nile. Pharaoh's fear has caused him to go from a disregard of history to a disregard of human life. It's interesting, the pattern, isn't it? It starts off small, the fear of man. But it can lead to a multitude of sins. We start with ignorance, then we move to fear, then affliction, then slavery, then murder and massacre. From anxiety to assassination, from terror to terrorism. Fear of man. But there's another fear in this passage, and we see that Pharaoh is afraid of the Hebrews, but the Hebrew midwives fear God. Verse 17, but the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them. And then again, verse 21, and because the midwives feared God, he gave them families. Well, this is a very different type of fear. And Ecclesiastes tells us this is the whole purpose of our existence, the whole purpose of our life, the whole duty of man is to fear God and keep his commandments. So what does it mean? What does it mean to fear God? Well, we see here three things the midwives did in fearing God over Pharaoh. We see that they feared God's punishment more than Pharaoh's, that they loved God's commands more than Pharaoh's, and they desired God's rewards more than Pharaoh's. They were faced with a very real threat. Pharaoh could take everything from them, including their lives. They are given a direct command from Pharaoh. And I'm sure there would have been rewards had they had gone through with it. But these midwives had a knowledge of God. And their knowledge of God meant that they looked at Pharaoh with all his power, and they knew that God was more powerful. They looked at the punishment that they would have had for not going through with this, but they knew that God's punishment for going against his rules would have been even greater. Matthew chapter 10, verse 28. And do not fear those who kill the body, but cannot kill the soul. Rather, fear him who can destroy both soul and body in hell. These ladies knew that God was bigger, that God was more powerful, and that God is a God of justice who punishes those who do wrong. And one day, the great mighty Pharaoh would stand before God for his crimes. And they feared God's punishment over anything that Pharaoh could do to them. And in their knowledge of God, they knew not only his size and his power, but they knew that he gave commands out of love. Pharaoh here reacts and commands out of fear. But God commands out of love. And the God who made us has given us rules to live by. And people say to me on the streets, is he some sort of dictator then? Live how I tell you to live, otherwise I'll send you to hell. But no, God loves, and his rules and his commands are the best way for us to live. The maker knows how the made should be treated. If you had a problem with your washing machine or your phone, what would you do? You would open up the manual that comes from the maker, and you would do what the maker tells you to do. Why? Because those who made it knows how it should be used. And the God who made us knows how we should live. And these ladies, they knew that God's rules were made from love. And they rejected Pharaoh's command. But they also know that God is not a God who, not just a God of justice and punishment, not just a God who gives commands and rules out of love, but that he is a God of grace and a God who loves to reward those who are faithful to him. The old hymn, Amazing Grace, we sing the words, 'Twas grace that taught my heart to fear, and grace my fears relieved. Here we have both types of fear, don't we? That Newton says that through grace, through God's love towards him, his heart is taught to fear God. In this reverential fear, in this awe of who God is and all that God has done for him. And also, through grace, his fear of man is relieved. These ladies, they looked to God, they trusted in him, they desired God's reward, and it meant that in the face of Pharaoh, they could have boldness and reject him. There's a great book, I don't know if you've ever read it, Intentional by Paul Williams. This is what he writes. If I've not been clear, then hopefully this is clear enough for what it means to fear God. This is what he says in a helpful illustration. When my twin daughters were toddlers, they used to love playing a game called Lions. The game was very straightforward. Susanna and Bethan would run into another room in the house. I would get on all fours, crawl into the room they were in, and roar like a lion. They would then run past me into another room, and I would then crawl into that room, roaring again like a lion. The girls loved it. They would giggle and scream with delight. And, as the game went on, they would whip themselves into an excitable frenzy. "Louder, Daddy, louder!" they would shout, wanting me to produce a bigger and bigger roar as I entered the room. On one occasion, the girls' giggling had turned into uncontrollable laughter, and their pleas of "louder, Daddy, louder" having become ever more desperate. I got up off my hands and knees, stood up as tall as I could, and ran into the next room. I let out the biggest roar I could muster. The girls burst into tears and ran towards me, grabbing hold of my legs. Once Mummy had arrived to sort out the mess I'd created and the girls had calmed down, I realized their reaction was a brilliant illustration of what it means to fear the Lord. My girls were genuinely frightened of me as I roared like a lion. They couldn't escape me. I was bigger than them and more powerful than them. But I was also their father. In their fear, they instinctively knew that the safest thing to do was to run to me. That's what it means to fear the Lord. God is the almighty creator of the entire universe. He is to be feared. But he is also our strength, our fortress, our stronghold, and our father. Running to him brings us to a place of ultimate security. Is that helpful? Hopefully. It was helpful for me. That God is to be feared. He is the God of justice. He will punish those who break his rules. But he is also our father. And we should lean upon him. And God rewards these midwives because of their fear of him, because they ran to him and lent in him and in his security and safety. And I feel like God's playing games a little bit with Pharaoh, because we read he gave them families. Pharaoh wanted less children to be born, and instead God gave these midwives children of their own. They were rewarded for fearing God. So there we have it. The two fears. Fear of man and the fear of God. One leads to death. The other leads to life. One breeds more fear, and the other brings peace in the face of fear. One is produced from selfishness and self-service, while the other comes from a service to God. So what can we learn from this? Well, I think firstly, we can see that God is faithful to his promises. And we see that right at the very beginning of Exodus. And that is true then, and it's true today as well, that God is a God who makes and keeps his promises. And even if it feels like he's not, even if it feels like he is slow to keep his promise, God is faithful to his promises. So if you are sat at home in a difficult situation, if you're suffering, if you're scared and worried, then God has made promises and he is faithful to them. He has promised to be with us. He has promised that all things work together for good for those that love God. He has promised to be near to those who are hurting and brokenhearted. He has promised to keep safe those who cling to him. And that should fill us with joy, shouldn't it? To know that the God of heaven and earth has made promises to you and I, and he will keep them. But I guess the question we have to ask is, who do we fear? Where do we fit in this passage? Are we like Pharaoh, or are we like the midwives? Do we fear man, or mankind, humans? Or do we fear God? Do we look to serve ourselves? Remember, that Pharaoh wasn't any danger. I'm not saying it's wrong to fear a man if he runs towards you with a machete or is kicking your door down. It's right in those situations to fear him. But that's not the situation that Pharaoh finds himself in, is it? What's under threat is his position, his power, his authority, his wealth, his kingdom. And how many times have we been in a situation where our credibility, our job, our wealth, our own little kingdom is under threat? And we take on the mentality of looking after number one. And we live for ourselves. We live selfishly. We may not go to murder or massacre, but we also act in ways that are sinful. Perhaps we have hatred. We resent people. Perhaps we remain silent when it comes to talking about Jesus. I know for myself, one application for me is that when I go to an open air and I am fearful, I know that they are not going to hurt me. The people out there, they're not going to attack me. They're not going to kill me on a public street. But I am afraid of my credibility, my social standing in that moment. What will they think of me? And that can cause me to stay silent. Perhaps in other situations, it could cause us even to lie. When we feel under threat and we lash out in selfishness, it always leads to sin. And I think, if we're honest, all of us can say that we have acted like that in our lives, that we have sinned against God because of our pride and our selfishness. And none of us have feared God and lived how he wants us to live. And that should strike fear within us, because God is a God of justice and a God of power. But the good news is that there was one who lived on the earth, who was tempted in every way as we are, yet he remained without sin. That when he was put in a position of shame, he was obedient to God's will and God's law. Jesus Christ lived the life that we could never live, but put himself in the place of punishment that we deserved, and died on the cross so that you and I could be forgiven. And it's only in him and in his obedience that you and I can have life. Where is your hope placed? Is it in yourself? Because that will just lead to the fear of Pharaoh. Or is it in the Lord Jesus Christ? If you haven't yet put your hope and trust in him, can I urge you to look at the gospel, to look at the life of Jesus, to look at his death and resurrection, to spend some time this afternoon thinking upon God and his power, the creator God who made all things by his voice. And ask yourself the question, if God was to mark all my iniquities, would I stand before him? Because the reality is we wouldn't. And the only way we can be right with God is through the Lord Jesus Christ. And if we have put our hope and trust in him, well, the temptation is always there, isn't it? To live for number one, to be self-serving, to fear those who are a threat to us. But the reminder here is to fear him, to put our hope and our trust in him, to run to him in the face of those threats, to lean on him and live as he has commanded us to, as Ecclesiastes says, to fear God and keep his commandments. By grace we have been saved, and grace leads us to fear God and live before him and live for him. And grace relieves our fears of those around us. Resting on the one who has made promises and is faithful to them. Amen.